happy Friday. It is the Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I am Ben Ennis. The text line open, 590, 590. And yes, I understand, Blue Jays fans, you're very restless. I heard from many of you yesterday when I was hosting Jays Talk after yet another loss to an AL East opponent. The Blue Jays dropped 3-4 to the Tampa Bay Rays. And yes, there's just no debating the fact that this team is underwhelmed to this point. They're only a game over 500. They're 26-25, 2-9 stretch against nothing but divisional foes. That was horrible, although it did follow a three-game sweep of the Atlanta Braves. Nevertheless, here are some things to perhaps placate you or make this stretch seem a little more tolerable or give you an indication that better days are to come for this Blue Jays team. They are fifth in baseball in position player war, okay? They're sixth in the American League in starters ERA, and they are tied for first in baseball in defensive runs saved. It has been bad. There's just no question about it. Last week and a half, horrible, 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 and there's real questions surrounding some of the major expected contributors on this Blue Jays team. None larger than the largest man on this Blue Jays team, Alek Manoah. That's a big question mark. But there is 111 games to go. Let me say that again. 111 games to go. And there's plenty of time to make up ground. And they're not playing an American League East opponent tonight. They got the Minnesota Twins, who lead their division, if you want to call it that, American League Central. Louis Varland on the mound against Kevin Gausman. Let's talk to Caitlin McGrath, the Athletic Jays reporter, who joins me on the line right now. How's it going, Caitlin?
It's good. Wait, you mean to tell me I still have to do 111 games of this?
I know, it sounds bad, right? Like, are you doing all of those games? Like, can you take some days off?
I'm taking today and tomorrow off tonight. Okay. I'm going to go see a movie tomorrow. So.
Okay, all right. All right, that's good. So is it panic time? Because I it's been really bad. But it's like the really bad part has lasted 11 games. And before that, okay, there were ups and downs, and it wasn't long before the Atlanta Braves sweep that they were swept at Fenway Park. You get that. It's been an up-and-down kind of start. But, like, April was pretty good. Where are you on the panic meter?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that, like, this last stretch has been really bad, and I think it's been, like, underlined because it's all come against their own division, you know, and the Yankee series was so dramatic for almost exclusively off the field kind of reasons. The Orioles are just probably a lot better, even though I think we all understood after last year, like, don't underestimate this team. I think they're still significantly better than even we all thought, probably. And obviously the Rays have just been excellent too. And so feels a little bit like rubbing salt in the wound a little bit, how this last stretch has gone in terms of, like, panicking or not. Like, it's obviously the real Jays team is somewhere in the middle of these highs and lows that they've been having this year. April was a really good month, and they played some good teams in April, and they played really well in April. What stood out to me, and I kind of wrote about this a little bit yesterday, it's like, you know, there's all these sort of, there's different concerning things about the team, whether it's like the offense, the fundamentals, the pitching, you know, I think a lot of those things look fairly fixable to me. Like, we've seen this team play good fundamental baseball. You said off the top, like, the defense actually is good in sort of the statistical sense, but we've seen them over these last 2 weeks make a lot of mistakes. They should be better at base running than they are. And we've seen them be really sharp. That Atlanta Braves series, they played really well, except for that last game when both teams decided to, like, not play well at all. But it's fine. They won. So there's a lot of things that, like, yeah, right now are kind of concerning. But then I look at them, and I'm like, I don't think they're going to be this fundamentally bad. I do think the offense is going to balance out a little bit. You know, the pitching, you know, three of the five have been really good. And, you know, I think that you try to hope that at least Kikuchi and Manoah, if not both of them, sort of figure it out here. So I'm not totally panicking because I can see a lot of ways in which some of these concerning trends can kind of turn around rather quickly.
Yeah, I'm with you, especially when you're talking about, like, the physical errors or mental errors or whatever is happening, like the sloppiness, the lack of attention to detail that's coming from guys that we know are good defenders. Like, yesterday it was Kevin Kiermaier and Matt Chapman. So what, like, we think those guys stink, like, defensively now? No. I mean, Kevin Kiermaier does lead, I think, Major League Baseball individually in defensive runs saved. But I guess as much as I'm with you, I think we're on the same page as far as it being fixable, it not being like an abject disaster. It's not time to like blow it up or anything because, as mentioned, 111 games left. The players obviously are at least concerned enough to have this players-only meeting, which, I mean, I'm going to talk to Caleb Joseph today, and it'd be interesting to get a player's perspective on it. But like, and it should be noted that maybe Matt Chapman didn't want us to know that they had a players-only meeting when it was revealed by John Schneider yesterday. What do you make of the fact that this team is closing the doors and they're hashing it out amongst themselves?
Yeah, I mean, well, a few things. Like, I wasn't there in Tampa. I wasn't on this trip. So I can't really speak to, like, how it came about that the media found out that there was a meeting. My guess would be they sort of put two and two together, and then, you know, with a closed door and just not being allowed in the clubhouse, which is unusual after games, and then maybe someone asked John Schneider that what is happening, and, you know, at that point I don't think he's gonna lie. Like, it's pretty obvious what's happening, right? So I understand, you know, that Chapman might have been like, how did you guys figure this out? Like, I don't know if I want to sort of like spiral and read into like that one comment so much, but just about the meeting, I mean, I think Caleb's perspective will probably be the better one here because he's probably been in a handful of those players-only meetings and can kind of tell you, like, what they're about. But, I mean, just from, you know, covering baseball the last few years, I mean, sometimes it's just a good sort of, like, check-in. Like, I think this Blue Jays team, they kind of knew, or they wanted to establish this identity at the start of the season as to be a tough team to beat. And what does it mean to be a tough team to beat? It means, you know, playing fundamentally well, not making those sloppy mistakes, you know, putting up tough at bats, like doing all these things that they wanted to be sort of the difference maker for them this year. And that was sort of key to them to say, you know, we're not just going to be a contending team, but we're going to be a seriously contending team. Like, we're going to, you know, compete for the division and all that kind of stuff. And so if they've come into the season saying that's going to be our identity in the last 2 weeks, that's been far from the identity that they've had. Like, it's probably a good time to check in with each other and say, hey guys, like, what are we doing here? Like, we know we're better than this. Like, you know, I think it's probably good timing for it. You probably don't want to let this go on any longer. And, you know, I don't know that that's going to necessarily be like an overnight fix, but I mean, it's probably something that at least had to happen, or at least they felt it needed to happen.
Yeah, it kind of turns tonight into a must win, though. I mean, you can't lose after a players only meeting with your ace on the hill. Like, I exaggerate slightly, but yeah, it does. That's the other thing about players only meetings, in my experience, Caitlin, not, you know, being on the road, not covering this team like physically in the building every day, but watching these things play out across the history of Major League Baseball, that it does, like, you don't want to have, like, two players-only meetings in, like, a span of 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also think you don't want to have, like, you don't want to have that players-only meeting and not come out looking sharper. You also don't want to have a game where you score 20 runs and, like, not able to build off that whatsoever. Like, if the whole thing is, like, you know, we just had to have this outburst and then it's all going to get going for us, and, like, how much more of an outburst did you need than 20 runs against the best team? And then you're still, like, I get it, like, the Rays are good. McClanahan shut them down. He's, you know, the best pitcher in baseball, or at least the best pitcher in the American League right now. Like, I get it. There was other things happening, and, you know, it's hard to sort of isolate a 20-run outing and say, yeah, okay, it's going to be fixed after this. But I do think, like, there's little things where it's like, yeah, like, okay, you had that outburst. You had a fun game. Now you've had a players-only meeting. So, like, what does it take? Like, at some point, at some point, you're just going to have to play better, right? And, you know, just do it consistently.
Yeah. That being said, I was really intrigued by you pointing out the statistically where the Blue Jays stand now through 51 games compared to where they stood last year through 51 games, where they had a 30-21 record. Again, their record this season, 26-25. Now, I will also remind people that the manager was fired like before the All-Star break there, and they were only three games over 500 in July, so it wasn't smooth sailing. But yeah, you look at the offense, they've been better offensively. They've been worse pitching-wise, but not significantly so. Like, what did you make of stacking those numbers up side by side?
Yeah, well, firstly, I was kind of surprised that at least the offense was almost, not like hugely significantly better, but like, you know, better. I know something that's people, you know, I'm not going to put too much in stock into like all the things that are sent in my mentions on Twitter, but one thing that's been common is like this team isn't hitting home runs. And then they've hit the same amount of home runs this year and last year. Now, I do remember last year the offense was really slow to get going. Like, yeah. I remember that there was like a stretch of games, and weirdly, there was a stretch of games early last year where they couldn't score runs, but they kept winning. Like, they were nothing.
Yeah, they were like, I want to say like 12-0 in one run games to start the season.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And they weren't like high scoring run games most of the time. They were like 2-1, 3-2, like all these very kind of low scoring games. That's not really been a pattern this year. You know, they haven't really been sort of squeaking out some of those like 1-0 games as much this year. But yeah, and the pitching, like you said, slightly worse, but not like hugely so. So it's kind of hard to decipher just from these numbers, like, what, you know, what is happening or why isn't the record as good. And sort of like the best, like, I don't know, hypothesis I could come up with or get best guess is like, I just think the teams around them are better. Like, I think the American League is better. I think that the American League East is certainly a lot better. The one biggest concerning thing that I think with this team is the hole that they've dug themselves when it comes to their own division. They're 6-15 against their own division, right? And I think I did the math yesterday, and they basically have to win 20 of the next 31 games against their own division to break even, to go 500 against the American League East. Like, that's a over 600 win percentage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's not great. That part is concerning. And I wouldn't say that, like, this is it's demonstrative of, like, how inferior the Blue Jays are compared to those beasts of this division. Because, yeah, I mean, you can take – this is – despite it being an 11-game sample that feels massive, it is tiny, tiny, tiny. You don't have to go back that far to see a couple of series victories. I mean, the first one that the Rays suffered, first loss mm-hmm. Of a series, first game they lost of the season was to the Toronto Blue Jays, and they had Yusei Kikuchi and Jose Berríos going in that series, and they took 2 out of 3 from the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. So I don't think they're, like, inferior just, like, in an overall sense to everybody within this division. I would say that if you're going to play some bad baseball, that was like a really bad time to do it, Caitlin. Like, is that fair? Because, like, everyone's going to go through their swoons, right? Like, even the Rays. Like, the Yankees were off to that insane start a season ago and then couldn't win a game in the middle of the season. All these teams are going to go through it. But when you have so few divisional games and so many of them are stacked in, like, a week and a half span, to go through your biggest slump of the season over that span, that part, I think, hurts the most.
Yeah, I think that's why it's probably the most concerning, because it's like, yeah, it's one thing to not play lights out during that stretch of play. It's another thing to go, what is it, like 2-13 over their last 15 against the American League East? That's going back to the sweep they had in Boston.
Yeah.
Like, that's not good. And it's funny because I remember covering that, obviously, at the start of the year where the Rays came into town and they won 13 in a row. And I remember watching that game and being like, wait, this is the team that won 13 in a row? Like, they were kind of booting the ball around, if you remember that game. And the yeah. Jays were the ones that looked very Rays-like. Like, they were, like, you know, not making a mistake, doing everything right. Like, and it was so funny because now, you know, a month later, it's sort of the complete opposite. And the Blue Jays are just the team that, you know, doesn't look sharp at all against a team like the Rays. And so you're right. Like, these things can change, and they can change really quickly. I mean, different division, far easier division. But I look at a team like the Cardinals, who were like even more of a mess than the Blue Jays were. Like, they were, I was like, what is even happening with that team? They had some just on-field mess, also kind of like PR messes, mm-hmm. messes and all that kind of stuff. So they were down bad. And I think they've been like the best team, one of the best teams in baseball of the last couple of weeks. And it's a really weak division they're in, but I think they've moved up all the way to at least not last. I think they're slowly making their way up. But I think, look, they're 5 games back. They're 5 games back of first. Again, much easier division, but you know, they're a team that's really turned it around. And so, you know, teams can look really, really bad when they're bad, and they can look really, really good when they're good. And usually somewhere in between is the true identity of the team.
Yeah, you just look talent, position for position, that this team should be good enough. But that being said, there are real issues. And like I mentioned off the top, like the biggest one is the large human that is Alek Manoah, Caitlin. Mm-hmm. And I know for a guy with a pretty good, first couple of years, and that's a long track record, we shouldn't, take this small sample and say, well, this means that he's no good, or like this should be a big concern, except there's like a differential. This season's different than the first two, right? And I think primarily it's the pitch clock. Like, I can't get away from it. And you look at the way he's laboring yesterday with Alejandro Kirk, and the way he was, kind of efficient and looked like he had lots of energy in his previous start with Danny Jansen behind the plate. I can't help but think that is there's a stamina thing happening with him. Like, what do you make of how different Alek Manoah looks this season?
Yeah, I think that I agree with you that, like, there's probably other things. I mean, the pitches look different, right? Like, the slider is not breaking the way. There was a bit of a dip in velocity. But, yeah, I mean, the big overarching change we've seen in baseball is the pitch clock. And we know that Manoah was not exactly a quick worker last year. He was pretty slow and deliberate, I think probably strategically so, right, to some extent. And that's taken away this year. You can't really do that. We saw the Rays completely exploit him yesterday in the sense that they were just running all over him because he was taking a long time to pitch. And there just was kind of a disregard there for the running game for a while. And, I mean, the Blue Jays in general have struggled with that this year with some of their pitchers. But, I mean, yeah, it's hard to diagnose, like, what exactly is happening with Manoah. I mean, I was listening to John Morosi on your network earlier this morning on the morning show. And it's like, yeah, I mean, maybe there is a physical issue. I mean, I sort of wonder, even looking forward, like, what do the Jays do from here? Like, okay, we can acknowledge that the season is not going well for Manoah. We can acknowledge that the pitches haven't been sharp. He's getting hit around. The slider is not as dangerous of a pitch. But, okay, what are the solutions here, right? Like, we've heard from them a number of times that the work in between is really good. The bullpens are going well. It's hard for us to sort of, like, sniff out if that's truly the case because mm-hmm. you can't really see those, but that's at least what we're being told, right? And the work is there and the effort is there, and I don't doubt that whatsoever. And Manoah between starts, I haven't been around him this week, but I know that in between starts he was seemingly the same guy, working hard, dedicated to figuring it out. But now it's like, okay, well, what do you do? Like, is there going to be an IL stint coming? Is there something, physically wrong or something, enough physically wrong that they can, put him on the IL? Like, I hesitate to pull the sort of, like, use in case of extreme emergency, like, option to minor leagues lever because this is a guy with a track record. And, I think that would be a pretty extreme measure. But I do think that this Blue Jays team save from like doing something drastic, which I don't think anything drastic is going to happen in terms of like change of personnel. Like maybe there has to be some sort of shakeup, and maybe it is giving Manoah a breather, skipping a start or, putting him on the IL for a little bit to figure something out.
No, it's a great point. And it actually, it leads me to my next, like, so we did the thing where we said things aren't so bad. Now we're going to like delve deeper into the things that might actually be bad. And Manoah's number one. The second thing is that there's no obvious option, right, in AAA as a rotation fill-in, right? Like, everybody stinks, and Ricky Tiedemann's hurt. And even mm-hmm. before he was hurt, he was starting to stink, despite the incredible start in AA. The Blue Jays have been the healthiest team in Major League Baseball, Caitlin. Mm-hmm. Like, they haven't missed a start out of their rotation. It's nuts. Nobody else has done that. That's not going to last all season long. Like, God bless them. Hope it does. It would be foolish for anybody to believe that that's going to happen. The depth on this team has yet to be tested, and they're going through this stretch of baseball right now. They're only a game over 500. Like, where's your level of concern about the players below the major league level with this Blue Jays team?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other, like, sort of, like, problem A and problem, or problem 1A and 1B, I guess, with the Manoah situation is that you have the Manoah, and then it's like, but what do you do? Like, what's the better solution? I mean, yeah, looking down at Buffalo, like, there's not a lot of great solutions. I think Zach Thompson, has not put up great numbers in AAA. Casey Lawrence is just sort of a journeyman, and obviously he's helped in the past. Drew Hutchison, again, like, journeyman status at this point. None of that is like, I don't think that's inspired a lot of confidence in you as I've listed off those names.
Yeah.
So like, what do you do? Maybe like, maybe there's a hybrid situation. Like I was like, okay, maybe I think you just optioned Hatch. So you could only call him back up if you did IL someone. But you know, maybe it's a combination of a Hatch, a Trevor Richards, and using Nate Pearson for two innings. And then you can kind of cobble, I don't know, five or six innings out of those three, and then you go to your bullpen. That could be something, but I don't know that that's something you want to do for more than one, maybe two starts. Like, that's not a realistic solution. And like you said, like, there's no one banging down the door. Ricky Tiedemann's hurt. And now, or, you know, obviously, even if he's getting better, there's not going to be any rush to get him. You know, they just want to get him right. Like, there's not really a priority to rush him, right? So that is another issue with the Blue Jays right now, especially with Mitch White now getting moved to the 60, which I guess it was backdated from the start of the season, so I'd have to do the math, and there's still a few days that he'd have to be on it, but he's, you know, he's not really close to being able to come in.
And he's Mitch White. He's Mitch White,
yeah.
Also.
Yes, yeah. That reminder, yeah. So, yeah, not like a lot of inspiring solutions. So on the one hand, like you said, it's great that the rotation has been very healthy. The Blue Jays are lucky that this has not been tested early. But it does sort of underline that this was an issue last year too. They didn't have great starting pitching depth, and they've added some this year. But again, it's like not really of the inspiring nature right now, because those guys are just kind of purely journeymen. But you know, maybe it's worth giving one of them a shot just to kind of give Manoah a breather.
Yeah, hard to do worse than Manoah's done in his worst starts this season. What movie are you going to go see tomorrow?
Oh, I'm going to see Blackberry. I've heard it's really good.
I've heard great things. I was listening to a podcast about it. The Gary Bettman is portrayed in the movie as well. So yeah, that's supposed to be amazing. Enjoy that.
Yeah, I hope so. I'll report back how it was.
Please do. Caitlin, thanks so much for doing this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, anytime.
Caitlin McGrath, The Athletic Blue Jays reporter. So it's not all doom and gloom. Like I said, like there's reasons to believe that the offense is going to be fine. The offense has been fine and run into some bad runners in scoring position luck. That the pitching has been not abysmal. At times it's been abysmal, but like in an overall sense, it isn't abysmal. They've also been super healthy though. So there's, I would say that the reasons for optimism do outweigh the serious reasons for pessimism this season, but there are serious reasons for pessimism. Before we take the break, I want to get to something that happened yesterday, and it definitely relates to what the Blue Jays have gone through the last 11 days. So Yankees, they lost 3-1 to the Orioles yesterday. Early on in that game, Aaron Boone, Yankees manager, was ejected. Fourth time this season. This is the two-time major league leader in ejections. It's the second time in a four-game span as well for Aaron Boone. And the Yankees, they're hanging in the American League East. You want to talk about a team that has not had the injury luck on their side? It's been the New York Yankees this season, but they're hanging in. They lose a tightly contested affair to a divisional opponent yesterday, but wasn't too long ago. Aaron Judge was hitting a game-tying home run in the ninth inning, and they were winning it in extras. Like, they are absolutely destroyed by injuries, but battling tooth and nail with their divisional opponents. But their manager is getting ejected a lot. And then after the game, was asked about the potential for those dust-ups with the umpires no longer happening in the future.
Next year, it looks like robo umpires are coming, most likely. It appears that way. It's not definite. I'm just wondering, are you advocating to keep human umpires in
yes.
the game?
You are? Yes, I would like that way. No, I don't want that. Clearly, he shouldn't have had to throw almost 30 pitches in that first inning. You know, I mean, so, but no, I'm not advocating for the robo. I think these guys do, for the most part, a great job and work really hard at it. And, you know, there's going to be, when you're playing for a lot, there's going to be some issues from time to time, simple as that. And you know, I definitely from a pitch count, I thought it hurt Clark a little bit, who I thought threw the ball really well against a tough lineup.
Talking about Clark Schmidt there. Okay, so there's two things that might be happening here, and I'll tell you which one I think is most likely happening. So one is that he's just lying. He's just straight up lying. He's like, I have to manage Major League Baseball games with Major League umpires the rest of the season. I can't say, hey, yeah, I can't wait for the robots to arrive and take all of your jobs. Although the umpires, like, don't lose jobs. I mean, it's the greatest thing in the world. There's total automation. We can dispatch of a home plate umpire, but that doesn't happen. They just get to, like, sit there and operate the machines. It's a great gig, six-figure salary. That could be one of the things that's happening. Maybe Aaron Boone is saying, I don't want to have a target on my back, although seemingly he already does because he's the major league leader in ejections and, again, has been the major league leader in ejections the last 2 years and has been ejected twice in the last 4 days. So that's a possibility. He's just a liar. And, like, a strategic liar. Wouldn't fault him at all for lying. The other potential thing that's happening there is Aaron Boone is saying, please don't take this tool out of my tool belt. It's a useful tool. I've used it a lot. I think there's utility to it. I think when your team's not going great, showing your players that you care, getting in an umpire's face, going to bat for your pitchers, that's valuable. And I don't want it to be taken away from me. On that note, to wit, John Schneider still sitting on zero ejections. Zero. And we saw him chirping from the dugout yesterday, not to the extent that an ejection was coming, but holy cow, like, if there is a utility to it, and I believe some managers think that, Aaron Boone might. Would you have not seen it over the last week and a half from John Schneider? Feel free. It's not like he's never been ejected as well, but this season, and certainly over this 11-game span, while your team is having closed-door meetings, might have been an opportunity for you to get in an umpire's face because, man, we might be running out of games where that's even possible. All right, when we come back. So I was early on this thing. And I asked Frank Saravelli on Tuesday about the fact that Kyle Dubas was represented by an agent that works for an agency that also has a player agent that represents Austin Matthews. And is that weird? And I was told, no, not weird. And it may not be. But I'll tell you who thinks it's, like, at least worth investigating, the NHLPA, because that's what's happening right now. There is an investigation as to the legitimacy of Kyle Dubas's representation as it relates to that firm also representing players. We'll talk to a former NHL player agent and a former NHL general manager. Brian Lawton joins me next as the Fan Drive Time continues. I'm Ben Ennis, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Planning on selling your home?
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Text line open at 590-590. So there are multiple reports now. The NHLPA is reviewing the relationship between Kyle Dubas and his agent for potential violation of the certified agent regulations. There are some regulations. Now, Chris Armstrong is Dubas' agent. He works for Wasserman Sports. That's the same agency that also represents Austin Matthews, among others, including Connor McDavid. Now, NHL player agents can't represent club employees. Armstrong, not an NHL player agent. He's a golf agent and represents Tony Finau, among others, but works at the same firm as NHL player agents, including one that represents the most high-profile Toronto Maple Leaf. So the NHLPA is investigating. Let's talk to Brian Lawton, former NHL player agent and former NHL general manager, current NHL network analyst who joins us on the line right now. How's it going, Brian?
Going fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for doing this. So, frankly, do you see a conflict of interest here? Like the way I laid it out, is there, in your mind's eye, a conflict of interest between the agent of Kyle Dubas and the NHLPA?
Well, a couple of things to do on background. I mean, Marty Walsh in there now. Maybe things are going to change, but traditionally, nobody's ever really looked at this. There's tons of hockey agents that do work with coaches. Everybody kind of knows that. It's not the NHL's issue. It's the NHLPA's issue. Maybe this is a sign they're going to start to look into it. But in this particular case, I think it's a really weak case to look into, particularly because you don't have a certified agent. There's nothing in the rules that somebody from a global firm like Wasserman couldn't do that. As a matter of fact, when I ran Octagon Hockey, we had a coaches division. Not NHL coaches, but represented all NFL and NBA coaches. So I think it's a whole bunch of nothing. I think the interesting part is that nobody's ever done anything about this, in my opinion, in the business going back certainly to the mid-90s.
So what could the potential problems be if you had an agent representing players and executives?
Conflict of interest. That's all you're dealing with. It's very straightforward, obvious as you would think. The NHLPA a while ago did not want that to happen. You could see why. You don't want to be representing a general manager in terms of Chris Armstrong's position on this, and then representing, for instance, Austin Matthews. I mean, that's just a straight conflict of interest. It's not something you can disclose your way out of, and I think it's a good rule. Mm-hmm. It's just never been enforced, particularly with coaches. There's tons of guys out there, and they know who they are, that represent NHL players, and they also do work on the side for free for coaches.
So in your opinion, then, is this a step in the right direction that maybe these things are coming into the light of day?
I don't know how much appetite will be for it. I find it interesting that it's in the news. We'll see what happens. I can't comment yet because, like I said, I think it's a terrible case to go after. I could spend 10 minutes with them and give them 20 other cases that are live, but, you know, who cares? Nobody's done anything about it. I don't care. It's just the way it is.
Yeah, okay. But obviously somebody cares enough, though, to launch an investigation. What do you make of the fact that the NHLPA is launching this investigation?
Too early to say. What does that mean, launching an investigation, really? Do you have any facts as to what that means?
No.
What due diligence are they doing? What penalties can they apply? Like, to me, it's, you know, show me some more facts and I could give you a more definitive answer. But right now, I think it's just pie in the sky.
We do have, well, at least we have one side of this story as far as facts about the way the negotiation went between Kyle Dubas and the Toronto Maple Leafs, and the way Brendan Shanahan laid it out with a contract extension being talked about at the trade deadline and then proposed immediately after the season and then handed to him at the end of the season before the media availabilities, and then a counteroffer that was much higher before he was eventually dismissed. Does that track to you? Like in the contract negotiations you've had as general manager, or seeing contract negotiations the general managers have had, does that timeline make sense to you? Is that normal for that to be taking place in that manner?
It felt like the ball was dropped a little bit somewhere in the process, you know, for people to think that it's locked down, and then other people to be coming back and making more offers in this particular case. It sounds like there was a disconnect. I don't begrudge anybody that gets representation. It makes good common sense to have someone represent you. For me personally, and for most of the GMs in the NHL, I'd say that is not the case. You are supposed to be an expert in negotiations, including your own. But I don't begrudge anybody, and I don't want to make it sound that way. I find it slightly odd, but I can't say it's an idiotic thing to do, because it isn't. And I'm not saying that about Kyle. But what I can say from what I've seen, like everybody else, is it just seemed like there was a disconnect in terms of everybody thought it sounded like from the Maple Leaf side that Kyle Dubas was going to come back and there was an agreement. If you could tell me the exact numbers, I could give you a lot more color as to whether or not things were abnormal as to, you know, offer coming in to change what everybody maybe thought was going to be the final deal.
Yeah, I find it
unfortunate, though, at the end of the day, though. I really do. It's, you know, having represented hundreds of NHL players, having done tons of contracts for an organization, being on both sides of it, I really feel, because you don't ever want to be involved in a deal mm-hmm. when somebody makes an offer, doesn't get the deal, and then makes a statement that I still want to be a right wing on your team, and that ship's already sailed. So from that perspective, I feel terrible for Kyle. It's very unfortunate. There's really no more I can say than that. It was very unfortunate, but I don't blame anybody, that's for sure. I know I have looked at this issue very closely. Seems to be divided how it was handled. I understand exactly from the information I have as to how it could go sideways.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm interested in you're talking about executives getting representation, because I wondered that same thing, because Kyle Dubas has been in rooms negotiating with player agents. He knows how negotiations go. He knows the ins and outs. He knows the organization intimately. I think he knows the number that he would likely be looking at. And you said, yeah, you don't begrudge anybody for using representation. It's maybe not usual. What would be the reasons for having an agent if you were Kyle Dubas and you decided not to negotiate your own contract?
Well, I can't speak for Kyle, but the reasons, obviously, that I said, it's not a bad idea for people to get representation. Some people can't express themselves as to how much they think they're really worth, depending on their personality and different things. You bring somebody in to be able to do that, to sing your praises, that can look at it a little bit more objectively than you can when you're in the middle of it. And, you know, the goal is always to get a deal, mm-hmm. not to not get a deal. So in this case, it failed. How the value was perceived, and I don't want to jump into that too much because I only have hearsay. Mm-hmm. Don't know what the actual numbers were. You know, from the hearsay, it appeared that the Maple Leafs offer was very strong in what goes on in the market. And I won't say what that number was, but in terms of what I've heard, it seemed like it was a very fair offer. So to try to jump that up seemed a little bit abnormal to me. There are only 32 of these jobs. You think it's hard to be a player and get a job. It's, you know, we can do the math, right? Yeah. 32 GMs, roughly 780 guys play a year in the NHL. So, you know, the odds are against you. You want to push it, but you want to end up doing these jobs, particularly if you like them. And that's why I feel very badly for Kyle Dubas.
Yeah.
I do believe he loved being the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. At the same time, I understand Brendan Shanahan's position. He's got to find somebody. The big thing that struck me about Brendan's comments were, I wasn't sure if this is what he wanted to do, and the jobs are really hard. Mm-hmm. If you're not all in, there's some really lousy days when you're a GM. It moves like molasses. It feels like trying to turn the Titanic when you're managing a team and when you haven't won the Stanley Cup and when you're trying to achieve your goals. It's just very slow. It's very methodical. Hard to give up those opportunities, in my opinion.
Yeah. Now, reports are that Kyle Dubas might have a soft landing in Pittsburgh, but we'll have to see. Getting back to,
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
I'm being hard on Kyle here. I think it could be perceived that way, but I think Kyle's excellent. I don't think he's infallible. Everybody makes mistakes. I'm not saying he did, but I think he's very learned. And if he goes on to Pittsburgh, which wouldn't surprise me, then good for him. I think he'll be better off for it. Mm-hmm. He really will be. He might be like the movie I saw last night, without as much time in between, American Underdog, about Kurt Warner.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Right, right.
So, wait, hold on. Are the Toronto Maple Leafs the Arena Football League in that comparison?
Not exactly, but maybe the point of the story being, you know, maybe Kyle will be better off, definitely, for his experience in Toronto. And, you know, you learn the most through adversity. And I just don't think this has been very fun for Kyle.
Yeah.
I think it went a little bit sideways. I think the goal was to get a deal. It didn't happen. And those can be painful experiences for anybody. So I do feel for him.
Yeah, no doubt. There's probably some regrets on both sides, I imagine. Man, I had never seen anything like we saw from Brendan Shanahan last Friday. And I mean in regards to like just laying out the entire timeline of contract negotiations and when they were first broached and when the emails were sent and that is stuff that I think is generally, you know, not discussed publicly. What did you make about that dirty laundry being aired in that manner?
Didn't look at it as dirty laundry, looked at it more as facts. Kyle chose not to discuss it. I think that's an excellent decision. At the same time, I think Brendan Shanahan felt strongly that he had to communicate what had transpired. He knew that anybody that could do a survey would realize that I would say a majority of the people liked the job Kyle Dubas had done. I was a guy that liked the job that Kyle Dubas had done. And yet at the same time, I felt like I was hard on Kyle at times in terms of his asset allocation of players. I felt like he stuffed me year after year on those comments because they had great regular seasons. But I also know I made those comments with one thing in mind. The only reason I ever wanted to be a GM was to win a Stanley Cup. I could not care less about the regular season, but it paled in comparison to what you're trying to build your team to. And I always felt like the Maple Leafs had a couple of issues that didn't get addressed properly. Incredibly talented team, amazing, great regular seasons, very, very minimal success in the playoffs.
Hey, but they took a game off the Panthers. Hurricanes couldn't do that. what, Brian? No, like seriously though. In and it's already done and said as far as the general manager no longer being employed by the Toronto Maple Leafs. But like, if you were a president of a team and evaluating your season in an overall sense, does the fact that the team that knocked you out is going to the Stanley Cup Finals and might win it, like, does that impact the evaluation process of how successful a season you had?
It's definitely part of the equation, but I think you reach a point in an organization's cycle or maturity where it feels like the first day of camp, there's only one theme, and that is we've got to at least make it to the conference finals. Eventually that turns over to the finals. I felt like Toronto was doing that. You know, I felt like their regular seasons in the past had been good. The monkey on their back was to get through the first round. They did that, and then it kind of ended abruptly. So that was surprising. And that ending abruptly would be weighted more heavily than another tremendous regular season if I had been the president. Mm-hmm. I would not have been pleased. I would try to go through all of the moves. I thought that the Maple Leafs were incredibly aggressive at the deadline. I loved the players they added. They still did not address some of the macro issues that you would think Brendan Shanahan had been talking about with Kyle.
What do you think some of those macro issues are?
Misallocation of, well, for me, when I wanted to be a general manager, the first thing I did is sit down and write out what my thoughts were on how to build a team, how to manage a team. And the very first line I wrote, and this does not resonate with everybody, but you have to determine where you're trying to get to, and that is what type of team are you going to build. And for me, the very first line I wrote, having been a center in the NHL, so this will make no sense, is that you build your team in both directions from the blue line. It's just a funky way of saying I believe that you have to have a good D first and foremost. I believe that you can have a bunch of really good forwards and have no chance to make it to the cup. I believe that you can have, you know, an above average D and have a chance to make it to the Stanley Cup. This is the strangest of seasons with so many good teams going out much earlier than anybody expected. The path in retrospect for two teams this year was really, it's really a shame because they ended up missing a golden opportunity. One is the Toronto Maple Leafs. The other is the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah. No, it's surprising. It looked like they were kind of on a collision course to meet in the Stanley Cup final, and nope, both bowing out in the second round.
They should have. The way it worked out, they should have. They both had a really clean path, I felt like, after the first round to make it to the Stanley Cup finals. It didn't work out. That speaks to how competitive the NHL is. That should give pause to everybody that's evaluating these things and say, look, even if you're the Boston Bruins, everybody was like, oh, they're locked to make it. Look at the season they had. They were never more than a 20 to 21% chance who wouldn't take the field against that? That's just the reality of it. Mm-hmm. It's hard for people to comprehend. We're not the NBA. You don't have the best player in the league and you're guaranteed to make it to the finals, or you have at least a 65-68% chance. Totally different in hockey.
It's true. Before we let you go, so now we look forward to who the next general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs is or will be. How appealing is this job? I know there's only 32 of them in the world, and there's only a certain amount that are available right now. But just in an overall sense, how appealing at this point in their cycle, considering the turmoil, how appealing is the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs job?
Incredibly appealing and in a lot of ways intimidating. You got to find the right guy. If someone called me and said, "Do you want to do this?" I would jump out of my shoes, and no one's called me, just to be clear. But this is the type of job. It's kind of one of those things you got to be ready to look death in the eye if you take this job and be comfortable with it, knowing that you could fail badly. But it's an incredible job. It's an incredible opportunity to push yourself. If you think you're good in this business, this is the job you want. So they'll have no shortage of candidates, trust me. Mm. No one will turn them down that they ask that isn't contractually obligated. They literally have the pick of the litter. I believe Brandon Shanahan will come up with somebody amazing. And I actually think that it's going to be a catalyst to them taking the next step forward as an organization.
Do you think that'll be one of the interview questions? Will you look death in the eye?
I'm being a little dramatic.
No,
and yet I'm dead serious about that. I am dead serious about it, though. Toronto is a very intimidating place. You cannot have two thoughts about that. It's like being an NHL player. People would always say, "What'd you like? What'd you think when you'd skate around? There'd be 18,000 people there. They're all jacked up. You might have played in Chicago Stadium." You'd be like, "Never thought about it." Mm. You train. You prepare. You do what you're supposed to do. They need to find somebody like that. If they do, and I believe they will, I do believe they will take another step forward in their quest to get back to winning the Stanley Cup.
Brian, this was a great pleasure. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks, Brian. There's Brian Lawton, former NHL player, agent, and general manager, currently an NHL Network analyst. We have another Toronto FC giveaway, this time for next Wednesday's matchup against the Chicago Fire FC at 7:30 down at BMO Field to enter for a chance to win. Text today's code word Thompson to 590-590. Again, today's code word is Thompson. Text us in to 590-590 right now to enter for your chance to win tickets to next Wednesday's game. Yeah, it's super appealing. You got to look death in the eye. I get it. These guys that end up in these career trajectories all are comfortable looking death in the eye. They welcome it. They're not afraid of making the big mistake, or you wouldn't eventually rise to the level of NHL general manager. There should be no debate. And I think if you got him alone and you had an honest moment with Kyle Dubas, he would tell you the same. Screwed up big time. Now, it might all work out for everybody, but he could have today still been the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs, making less than maybe he thought he deserved. He screwed up. I guarantee you, he'd prefer to be the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs than the general manager of the Pittsburgh Penguins, despite the fact that he's got an all-time great Sidney Crosby and Genny Malkin, who just missed the playoffs, by the way, and are in their late 30s. So that's that. All right, when we come back, Blue Jays, Minnesota Twins tonight from Minnie. We will talk to Caleb Joseph of Blue Jays Central, former Blue Jays catcher. You know what he's going to do? He's going to saunter up here, and we're going to talk in person, face-to-face, if he's able to locate the studio. That's next, we hope. Fan Drive Time continues. I'm Ben Ennis, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Breaking down the top stories in hockey and Elliot Friedman every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm Ben Ennis. Blue Jays against somebody who does not play baseball in the American League East, so that's good. They're going to play a division leader tonight, Minnesota Twins, but it's the American League Central. Give me a break. It's a joke. Joke division. Caleb Joseph found the studio. He's trying to figure out which button is the on button for the microphone.
It's lit up. Yeah, the red one's lit up.
We don't trust you to touch that button. No, somebody else did that for you.
Keep your hands on the table.
How's it going, man?
Good, good. You look sunburnt. Did you?
Yeah.
Did you swing the sticks today?
I may have. I was like out at the crack of dawn this morning, getting it in early.
You lucky dog.
Yeah, it was a little chilly. Like next week is going to be warmer, and that time is going to be a little more palatable. But like third hole, had the sweater off, right?
It's beautiful out there right now. Absolutely beautiful.
No wind. It was really. Mm. I wish I played better, but
no
yeah.
excuses then.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Great
have
weather,
any.
No wind, no. No excuses.
No, no. Yeah, I have no physical maladies. No, I should be much better, but like I stink. All right, man. So Blue Jays. Speaking of stinking, 2 wins in their last 11. It's not great. Not going great against some teams that are above them because everybody is in the American League East. Okay, they won one of the four against the Tampa Bay Rays, scored 20 runs in that game.
Yeah.
But things are going so ugly, and it's a lot of facets, but I think the sloppiness is the main reason they had this players-only meeting yesterday. I want to get your perspective on it, because I'm sure you've been in your fair share of players-only meetings. How can those things go?
They can go whichever way. There's no rhyme or reason. I've been a part of meetings that worked. I've been a part of meetings that did absolutely nothing. I'll go back to 2019, my first year with the Diamondbacks, and the team was trying to make a run at it. We had a players-only meeting late in the season, right around the 1st of September. We were 4 or 5 games out, and we could really make a push. Everything was said. Right out in the open, everything sounded good, and it didn't make any difference. We did the same thing over and over, kept losing. It was as if the meeting was a total waste of time. Yet, my 14 team that I played on that won an AL East championship, we had a couple team meetings, player only, closed doors. We had some stuff going on internally with the club, and there was some division starting to happen. We were able to bring it together. And we ended up winning the American League East. And that was a big meeting. I remember it like it was yesterday, and it changed the course of our season. Anytime a player says something player to player in a group setting, it's going to mean more than a coach or a manager. Not to say that what they say manager or coach-wise doesn't matter. It does matter. It holds weight. But player to player, it just to a man, it can drive some people. And, that's – from my little digging that I did in the last day or two, it was player led, and it was kind of a let's get it going. Like now's the time, let's do it. So it could work, it could not work. I've seen it both ways, but hopefully it works, right?
Yeah. What do you think? Like, did they have a rundown of topics at this players only meeting? I doubt that they did. But like, if you were running that thing, if you were Matt Chapman, who feels like one of the leaders on this team, and he's been pretty great to start the season, despite the fact that his May wasn't as good as his unbelievable April, and who could possibly have expected him to do that? But he's also had, like, a couple of defensive miscues, too. Like, he's been part of the sloppy play, which is surprising for a guy that's a platinum glove winner, too. Like, what is that the number one thing that you would be talking about if you were, you know, in one of a players-only meeting for this team, the way they're playing right now? Would it be the sloppiness? Would it be, like, the attention to detail stuff?
No doubt about it. It's self-inflicted wounds. Because when you look at this kind of two-week stretch, they've pitched well enough to win quite a few games. Their starting pitching has actually been pretty good. They've given the team a chance to win just about every time, outside of maybe one or two starts where it was kind of over in the third inning. They've given them a chance. They've had a couple blown saves in the bullpen. Their defense has been pretty good, yet there's been games where when they had the pitching, when they had the offense, the defense wasn't there. And then they've had the good offense production, and then they run into some outs on the bases. They just haven't been able to really put it together. And if I'm a player in there, you're talking about playing a complete, solid, clean Major League Baseball game. We talked about this ad nauseum, it seems like, last year, that if you don't beat yourselves, you like the way the team's constructed, that they're going to have a chance to win quite a few games. Yet, how do you not beat yourself? Is it playing with aggression and going out there and not being afraid to make a mistake, playing with your hair on fire and going after it, or do you make mistakes by trying not to make mistakes? And I think that's a big point that sometimes major league players, like when you know the task at hand, like we've got to play a really good game, you start getting all tense up and then before you know it, like you get the tricky in between hop, and that's what happens in this game.
But that it's interesting you bring that up, because that was like the number one point of emphasis at the beginning of the season, right? It's like let's all play clean baseball. Sure. And it's really, there haven't been too many long stretches where they have played the clean baseball. Could that be it, that they're focusing too much on playing clean baseball, that it's in their head and they're incapable of playing clean baseball?
Yeah, it's very simple, Ben. This is what pressure does.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a team that a lot of people picked them to win the World Series. A lot of people have picked the Blue Jays to be good, to make it to the playoffs, at least in the few short months that I've been covering a team. This is the first kind of, this team could win a World Series talk around a lot of these players. And it's a lot. I mean, I was never involved in a team that was picked to win the World Series. I was involved on some good teams that made the playoffs, but never like win the World Series. And this is what pressure looks like. When you start losing 2, 3, 4 in a row, you start seeing the way the standings are bunched up, and you see in what seems like 1 week's worth of time, you go from second to last. Everything just starts to tense up. And so having the ability to just relax and go do what you do, bring what you bring as a player. That's the biggest thing, is you can't be somebody you're not. Mm-hmm. And if everybody brings what they bring, if you're an on-base guy, get on base. If you catch the ball late in the game as a defensive sub, go catch the ball. If you're supposed to hit it out of the ballpark, hit it out of the ballpark. And if you bring what you bring, mm-hmm. the construction of the team is good enough to win games. And early on, I felt like they played pretty clean, solid baseball.
Yeah,
and
then
just
good.
Out of nowhere, you lose 2 or 3 tough ones, and then you start pressing a little bit. And it happens. I've been on teams like that. But you've got to collectively just let the air out and just, like, relax. Like, we're fine. Relax. Relax. Go play. Do what you do. Bring what you bring. Play your game as an individual and as a team. You'll have success.
Now, are players like fans in that, like, fans – I know intellectually they understand there's 111 games left,
right.
But it's hard, right?
When
11 games feels like forever, because it's been a week and a half and they play every day and every game looks horrible, right? It's like against teams that you're competing with in this division, it feels like it's never going to end. It's all going down the drain and they're only a game over 500. 111 games, Caleb. Like, as players, do you have that zoom out, or are you like fans where it's like, it's hard? Like when you go to the ballpark every day, it's another L.
I would say for the most part, you kind of live in your own little world. Mm-hmm. And until it gets to this type of length where you haven't had success, that's when you start to go, okay, like something's wrong. That's when you kind of know maybe we do need to meet as a team. If you go on, you try and judge it in 10 game spurts as a player. So you try and judge it in 10 games. And especially dependent if you're on the home, not the home, if you're at home or on the road, you try and play 500 ball on the road, and then you try and play 650 at home. That's typically a pretty decent way to make it to the playoffs. So you're looking in 10-game stretches. Well, if you look at the last 10-game stretch and then a 10-game before that, it's no good. And that's when you start to realize, okay, this isn't going to cut it. This isn't going to make it. But, yes, and this has been the funny transition for me as a – player to a fan, is I'm more tense and I'm going, man, I went through this over and over and over. And if you were in it, how would you feel? And yes, I would know something's wrong and we need to get it together. Yet I would not be hitting the panic button as if I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
And as a fan right now, I'm going, they got to do something. They got to do something.
Right.
Do something now. Go trade for somebody. Go do something.
111
games.
You know, but 111
games. There's an eternity left, and they just got to make it. If they get in, anything can happen.
It's true. I mean, the goal was, and I guess still is, the top of the division. It's a big task ahead of them, and they're going to need, I mean, just like mathematically, for the Rays to fall off the pace a little bit if they want to do that. There's obviously a good stretch of baseball still ahead for this Blue Jays team. It might come during a stretch of games where they're not playing their divisional,
that would be nice,
foes. So, like, there's panic button stuff that you can do, and there's stuff that you can do to, like, kind of change up the monotony, or just, like, alert everybody to the fact that, hey, this is going bad, and we got to do something different, like a players-only meeting. Last hour, I talked about Aaron Boone getting ejected twice in the last 4 days, and his team's playing pretty well, actually, and they've been injured all over the place. Like, everybody's injured on that Yankees team, but they're hanging in. He's always among the league leaders in ejections. John Schneider was not pleased at times with the strike zone yesterday. We haven't seen him get ejected this season. We've all seen Hoosiers. Like,
yes.
It can work, right? Like, where are you on manager ejections? Like, not intentional, but kind of intentional.
I love it. I mean, I grew up watching the Atlanta Braves, and Bobby Cox was getting
all-time leader.
Getting heave-hoed all the time. Yep. And look, some people are going to roll their eyes and say that doesn't matter. But I'll tell you, when you watch a hockey game and the club needs a spark, they send out some big guy and he drops the mitts. And it sometimes it provides a spark. It gets a little energy. And at this point, what do you have to lose? But and I liked it. I liked it as a player. But again, I've got a hockey background, too, where I'm going, yeah. It's like he just dropped the gloves for us. Like, that's my interpretation of an ejection. Some people may not see it. But, I grew up a Braves fan. So watching Bobby Cox get heave-oed, I felt like it mattered. But yeah, if I'm the manager, I'm getting heave-oed because I'm trying to spark the club.
And I
don't want to watch the style that they've been playing either. Right. So
yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. There's a fridge full of Bud Lights that you go visit. I'm with you 100%. Doesn't mean that it's like some failing of John Schneider, but it would be something that I'd be thinking about using. So that's you know, Band-Aid on a pretty bigger issue. The biggest issue in my eye is Alek Manoah and what's happened to him this season. And it's not been every single start. I mean, you just have to go two starts back to look at a pretty decent one against the Baltimore Orioles. But that looked like a different dude than the guy we saw yesterday. And Buck Martinez on the TV broadcast mentioned it repeatedly that he was laboring out there, like the tempo. I know everybody has to work at a certain tempo, but sure, like he was maxing out the pitch clock each and every pitch seemingly. And I know it's not the only reason, but I'm sure it's part of the reason why the Rays were able to run roughshod behind him, right?
Oh yeah.
So what do you make of that? What do you make of the switch up, like Kirk back behind the plate after Jansen had caught him the previous start against the Orioles, where he was pretty good and only had the one walk and then had the five yesterday?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. I do think that he needs to work quicker. You know, there's an old baseball movie, Bull Durham.
Love it.
Says, don't think, kid, or actually I think he calls him meat. Don't think meat. You can only hurt the ball club. Yeah. And there were times last year when we applauded Alek Manoah for being so mature to be able to step off and assess the situation, and when runners got on base to slow the game down and really concentrate on his execution, this and that. Well, this is a totally different season. Him slowing the game down now is him trying to figure out what's going on, not how am I going to navigate this lineup in trouble, yet how am I going to get this pitch to that location because I don't know where it's going.
So you think it's a mental thing? It's not like him trying to re-get his breath, right? Like it's not a stamina thing?
I think it's a little bit of stamina, and I think this guy's trying to figure it out on the mound. And the big leagues is such a tough place to try and figure it out, whether it's swinging, whether it's throwing, whether it's any of that stuff. But I do think there was a blueprint there when Danny caught him. He really established the glove side fastball. And I'm all over this because when you have a guy that is really struggling, whether it's repeating his windup, whether it's getting certain pitches to certain spots, to throw a fastball from a right-handed pitcher, which Alek Manoah is, to the glove side, which is inside to a lefty, outside to a right-handed hitter, and be able to stick it and have that ball four-seam stay true, you have to do so many things right. You have to be in your legs. You have to stay over the rubber. You have to get down the mound correctly. You have to get over your front side, over that front left hip. You got to get over the fastball. And all these things promote good direction. They promote things that are good in repeatability of windup. Why is that important? Because you see these arm side misses. You see sliders that move too much horizontally. You see dead fish changeups that aren't dropping. All of these things is just inconsistency of windup. What I thought Danny Jansen was able to do was get him in a rhythm, establish that four seam to the glove side. It got his wind up in motion. It got him in a repetitious mode where then when he has to throw that slider, his hand position, his body position, all of those type of things are in the right spot. Mm-hmm. And now he can actually execute his pitch. When you're asking Alek Manoah, who has not had a great season, to go fastball away, change up down and away, backdoor slider, back foot slider, up fastball, sinker in, right out the gate for a guy who's struggling in his mechanics and struggling with his location, it's a lot to ask. So I felt like they deviated from that yesterday. He wasn't able to establish anything, and he met some resistance with that. Danny has done this with Jose Berríos. Nobody has really, well, there's been some people to point it out, but when Berríos gets that fastball to the glove side, Danny's been doing it. He's been setting up off the plate, getting him all the way to that outside corner to the right-handers. When he sticks it there, his breaking ball is right behind it. It sets up the entire AB, and I felt like he did that with Manoah. They just went away from it. So whether it's Kirk or Jansen, I really hope that they can get back to that.
Yeah. I mean, that seems like something that somebody could, like, if that was something that worked for Alek Manoah, could be imparted to Alejandro Kirk to try and activate.
Pretty simple.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's catcher specific, right? Because
no,
I know he had the successful start. He had a pretty successful season with Alejandro Kirk as his primary catcher a season ago,
right?
Like, so do you think this is a thing where he needs to go back to Danny Jansen for the rest of the season, or is that something that, you know, can go back and forth, or that the game plan could just, like I said, be imparted to Kirk and he could employ it with his starter?
Yeah, you'd hope that, especially if Jansen has to go on the IL, which I hope he doesn't, you'd hope that Kirk could be able to employ kind of this type of strategy. Yet, when Manoah's on the mound, you got to take that scouting report, crumble it up, and throw it in the trash. It shouldn't be about who he's facing. It should be about what does he need to do to get through the game. What does Manoah need to do? When you're constantly throwing to hitters' weaknesses and it doesn't match up with your strength in particular, you're up a creek without a paddle. And I think that's one thing that when you look at what Danny's able to do is he's able to establish that routine, that glove side four seam without burying Manoah. It doesn't mean you go throw 25 in a row, but knowing that pattern, it takes experience. It takes reps back there knowing I want to establish this, but the game and the situations, whether there's runners on, the score of the game, how he's laboring that inning, it all matters. And it's really hard to quantify. It's really hard to sit here and explain to you when you know, okay, now's a good time when I can throw a slider, or let's go change up. But, oh, man, those two changeups weren't very good. I need to get him back online, which might be a fastball to the glove side. It's all these if-then statements, and you just have to have experiences. It just takes years and years of knowing certain sequences and knowing those pitchers and what gets them back on track. So hopefully they can both do it. But I think Danny, in terms of his maturation at the catcher position, is a tick ahead.
Well, and also this is brand new for Alek Manoah too, right? Like, he's never struggled
ever
at, like, any place.
It's the worst place to struggle. Bennett Matters. I've seen this so many times. I saw this with Manny Machado. Manny never really struggled in the minor leagues. He struggled, I think it might have been 15 or 16, he hit like 170 the first month of the season. He was a totally different guy. He never struggled before, ever.
Yeah.
And to struggle in the big leagues is massive. It's everything's so magnified.
They
it's
show
so
your numbers
magnified.
On a giant yes. screen.
And there's 15 writers and six cameras in your face after every game going, why didn't you get a hit? Why didn't you get a hit? And you're sitting there going, I have no idea why. I have no idea why.
Yeah, I go out and shoot 90. Nobody asked
exactly.
me about it. Like, I don't have to share it on the radio. I just did, but I shouldn't have.
And you and you might have one or two kind of beat reporters for the local AA team asking you a question here and there, but it's constant. It's every night. And now even social media has even exploded where you're on television, and goodness, I mean, if you're struggling, you get on that Twitter thing. Oh man, like it could be disastrous. So, and I know players do that. I did it when I played. It's hard not to. Like, it's just part of it. So everything is so magnified. When you struggle for the first time here, you can dig yourself into a bit of a rabbit hole.
Yeah. And people can try and tear you down even when you're like overall doing well, like Vladdy. Vladdy's did. The overall numbers look good. Sportsnet Stats just tweeted out today that he is first in Major League Baseball when he has no strikes or one strike. His batting average is .461. Dead last, or sorry, fourth worst in Major League Baseball when he has two strikes on him this season, hitting .105. So he steps up to the plate last night in the top of the ninth inning, representing the tying run.
Uh-huh.
He didn't get to two strikes. He swung the first pitch, which was not a strike, but he grounds out. And this is a guy, again, overall having a fine season. And you know what? His career, he's been a fine player. He was an unbelievable player in that 2021 season. But this is not the power start that I think people would have envision for Vladdy, and like some of the like Statcast numbers are real good, and like the launch angle is much higher. He's hitting the ball just as hard as he ever. The strikeout rate is starting to rise like recently. But what are you seeing out of Vladdy offensively recently?
Like you said, the numbers are hard to argue. They're pretty similar. What I see when it comes to power is such a unique thing that a lot of guys are just born with it. And then if you try to have power, sometimes it can go the opposite way. Vladdy's the type of guy that when he makes contact out in front, it's going loud and hard somewhere. For me, it's a refined approach. When Vladdy continues to go up there, and it seems like he's trying to cover all pitches in all zones.
So, yeah, explain approach, like what that means.
Sure. Approach is when you're on deck, you know the matchup. You know the guy that is on the mound. You have an idea of what he throws in terms of pitches, in terms of locations. You're trying to figure out what do you want to go up there and look for. It's not as easy as just covering all pitches in all
zones.
C-ball,
hit ball.
Well, that's how you want it to be, but it's C-ball, hit ball inside of your approach.
Yeah.
If you're trying to cover all quadrants with all pitches, the guys are just too good these days.
That's right.
They're too good. The velocity's too high. The breaking balls are too sharp. You've got to eliminate a side of the plate, up or down, in or out, and then you're looking hard or soft. That's the easiest way. Now, you get guys with really refined approaches. They're going up looking hard in or soft away or soft up or hard down. These are really refined approaches. It seems easy, but it takes years to figure out how to do this because it takes trust. Mm-hmm. What if the guy throws you a first pitch fastball and you're sitting soft away and it's right down the middle?
Yeah, take it.
You have to take it. You have to be disciplined to take it. I wasn't that guy. I got paid to figure out what guys were doing in their approach and throw around it. So
right.
I know all about this because I was the guy behind there. I was not any good at executing it. Otherwise, I would still be playing. I wouldn't be talking about it. But I feel like Bo has gotten to that point where his approach is so refined now that he knows exactly what he's looking for. And that's why you're not seeing him chase as much, because he's super aggressive in that zone. And remember, we've talked about Bo chasing. Well, I haven't really heard that this year.
No.
It takes years to figure out how to trust yourself, how to understand your approach, and knowing how to get there. Sometimes, I don't care if the guy is a really nasty slider, he throws it 80% of the time. If you are terrible at hitting sliders, why would you sit that?
Yeah.
So there's this process you have to figure out of what you want to look for, how to do it, how to execute it. But if Vladdy gets to that point where he can maybe look out over the plate, let go of the inside half, he won't swing at that pitch from Poche that's cutting on the inner half. He'll let that go, knowing that he can't throw three pitches inside to me for a strike, and now he's got to hang a changeup, and I'm looking soft out over, and blammo, and now the game's tied. But or it could be the opposite. Or he could look hard in,
yeah,
and instead of getting jammed, step in the bucket and get it down and get it singing and let it fly.
I mean, we've seen him hit pitches in that spot. I mean, off Garrett Cole into the seats in left field, right?
That just tells me, like, the swing tells me he didn't have a refined approach.
And is that, like, is that just a guy that's had so much success just, like, seeing ball, hit ball,
he's
right?
He's been
like,
better than everybody everywhere he's been.
He's like, I don't need an approach.
Exactly. And even in his major league career, he probably didn't have to, like, really keep it refined.
Yeah.
Yet, as you get older, it's just, if you want to be a great player, you those guys have approaches, period. Like, nobody's up there just see it, hit it. I know it sounds, did not. They're see it, hit it inside a very refined approach. And
two strikes, it goes out the window, right?
Yeah, hitting in the big leagues with two strikes is dang near impossible, no matter who you are.
Yeah.
That's why you don't get the two strikes. You know, you mash the mistake that they give you. They're going to give you maybe one, maybe two in the big leagues. You're going to get one mistake in the big leagues, maybe two. The games when you rack up 10 strikeouts and you get four hits is when that pitcher made like four mistakes the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to give you one, maybe two, NAB, and you better move it forward when you get that mistake.
All right, before I let you go, I mentioned golf. I know you're Mr. Golf. I know you know who Michael Block is.
Yes.
What a performance at the PGA Championship. 15th, he's a club pro. He doesn't even like go to the range, right?
Love it.
Like, had a hole in one on Sunday. Is in tears. Like, just great, great story. Given sponsors exemptions all over the place. You can see him at the Canadian Open next month.
I'll be there.
Here in Williams, here in Toronto.
Yep.
Okay. I'll see you there. Charles Schwab Invitational, given a sponsors exemption this week. And unfortunately for Mr. Block, dead last. Yesterday he was 81. Bounced back a little bit today, 74, 15 over par. Michael Block, still a good story. Like, what have we done to poor Michael Block, who he didn't ask for any of this?
I know.
And, like, it's all net positive for
him.
Right? But, like, there are guys that are on the PGA Tour, like, that's their career,
right,
who make cuts all the time. Like, they're life and death to make the cut. What chance does Michael Block have? Poor Michael Block.
Yeah, I do kind of feel sorry for him. It's I don't know if people are familiar with the movie Rudy. It would be like Rudy Rudy going into the next game and getting absolutely smashed and knocked out, right? And just like the end. That's why the underdog movies only last 2 hours and 30 minutes. And they're
right.
Not 6 hours where they have their moment and then it's done. It's over. Like, don't go play another game. Like, that's it. Like, Miracle on Ice. Like, that team, they won. They beat the Soviets. And that was it. Like,
yeah,
we're just going to hang it up. Like, don't try and do it all again. Go switch the team up. Like, you got your 15 minutes. That's it. But, yeah, I think everybody can still relate to him, though. We've all had those rounds or those games or any experiences in life when you feel like you're on top of the world and you're like, yeah, maybe I can do this.
Yeah.
And then, wah, 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 you know, and it's like, okay, now I kind of remember, like, why I am a club pro. And I do that all the time. I will hit one shot around.
Yeah.
Where I'm going, I think I should think about this.
Yeah.
And then, no.
And I'm never going to hit another bad shot.
No.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like, I figured out. It's
exactly.
The one swing thought, and then, yeah, oh, I've lost.
That's
it.
That's it. I've got it. I figured this game out. I mean, I've got friends that I call and say, I got it. Like, there's a swing thought that I got. It's it. I hit the ball great today. I will show up the next day, and I might as well swing left-handed.
Yeah.
So we all can relate to that. But you know what? He's probably still living out a dream. And the fact that he bounced back, that's good.
Not bad.
That's good.
74. I mean, it's, yeah.
And that shot off the bridge, that was pretty sick.
Yeah. 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 The leaders are putting it in the mid 60s because that's what they do at, you know, PGA Tour events routinely. But good for him. And again, it'll be a great story and he'll have a nice gallery, I imagine, next month at the Canadian Open. Caleb, always a pleasure.
Yeah, you got it.
All right, we'll be watching you on Blue Jays Central. Get ready for the Blue Jays and Minnesota Twins from Mini on Sportsnet 1 tonight. When we come back, we'll talk to Eric Francis, Sportsnet Flames reporter, as the Fan Drive Time continues. I'm Ben Ennis, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Discussing the biggest stories that matter to Toronto sports fans. The Fan Morning Show with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I am Ben Ennis. So Bradtree Living, still the odds-on favorite to be the next general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Last check, you know, is minus 110 over the field to be the next general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. He knows the Canadian market. Of course, just most recently, the Calgary Flames general manager. And let's talk to a man who covered his career in Calgary, Eric Francis, Sportsnet Flames reporter. How's it going, Eric?
I'm excellent, Ben. How are you, my man?
I am doing well. Final segment on a Friday. It's a fine place to be. So do you think, just frankly, is Bradtree Living up to the job of being Toronto Maple Leafs GM?
Yeah, I mean, this has been in the cards for at least half a year in my mind that this was going to be a very real possibility, and here we are, and I feel no differently than I did back then. And I think that.
I love when that happens. When the phone blows up, like, I hate when the phone blows up, but like, there is something poetic about it happening right as like we're about to get to the reveal of the answer. Like, here's what I think. And then the phone just disappears. All right, Eric, we got you back. You were just about to like say something incredibly insightful. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I thought this was going to be something that was going to happen for a long time. And the only caveat really is, you know, all these reports, rumors coming out of Toronto that, you know, Shanahan's just a little too invested or, you know, I don't want to say interferes, but however you want to put it. And I don't have any anecdotal evidence of this, but people just worry that maybe he's a little tougher to work with. Than previously believed. I'm not saying that's true. But if that is the case, that would be the only reason why this might not happen. Because Brad Treliving, quite frankly, does not need the money, does not need the job. He comes from a very wealthy family. His father, Jim, is worth upwards of $700 million, I'm told, with his Boston Pizza empire and plus. You know, this is just about Treliving finding something that he thinks is a perfect fit, because he can, I really believe he can write his own ticket around the league in a lot of ways. I think if he wanted to wait, he could probably be the president of hockey operations somewhere, which is a much cushier job than general manager. But then again, he's a workaholic and he loves being in the trenches. So if he wants the job and he's comfortable with the arrangement that is arranged with Brendan Shanahan, then yes, I absolutely see this coming, and I've seen it coming for a long, long time.
Yeah, and part of the appeal, I guess, for some people is that he is not afraid to make the big move. I mean, pushed into a corner, obviously, after Johnny Gaudreau leaves and Matthew Tkachuk indicates he's not going to re-sign and, you know, may have inadvertently built a Stanley Cup champion there in Florida, but certainly a big swing. what do you think of that selling feature, that if this Leafs team needs a stick of dynamite, that he's the guy to do it?
I think it's the biggest reason why he is the guy to do it. And it's not just last summer when the whole hockey world watched him, you know, swap out Tkachuk after losing Gaudreau and then getting a pretty good return on paper anyway for Matthew Tkachuk, and then somehow finagling, you know, Kadri, which a lot of teams wanted around the league. And, you know, at the end of the day, it didn't work out. But it wasn't just that deal. Like, you know, I think other people remember, and I'm sure – you know, Tree's getting lots of ink over the last couple of days, but that trade with Elias Lindholm and Noah Hanifin many years ago, I mean, that's a masterful piece of, you know, I would argue that that's one of the top five trades in the NHL over the last decade to bring those two cornerstones here to Calgary. So he's always been, savvy and not scared. And, you know, that's what everyone's led to believe is the task at hand in Toronto, right? Someone's going to have to come in there and make some tough decisions, or at least one really, really tough decision on one of your core players. And whether that's the truth or not, we're about to find out, I guess, in the next couple of months. But if that is the case, he is certainly up to the task.
Eric, I love talking in serious tones about sports and about hockey, but it's kind of difficult when you look at, you know, the way the regular season played out. Calgary Flames end up with one more point than the Florida Panthers. The Panthers make the playoffs because the Penguins lost to the Chicago Blackhawks. Here go the Panthers to the Stanley Cup final, could win it all. And Brad Treliving, you know, he screwed up royally because he traded the guy that had to be traded, and he's going to win the Conn Smythe Trophy. It's all ridiculous, isn't it?
It is ridiculous when you add another layer, which is, okay, so as it turns out, it doesn't look like a great trade right now. Obviously, Brad had to make a trade, whether it was that trade. He had to make a trade because Tkachuk made it clear he wasn't coming back. But now, even though that trade didn't work out that well, and that reflects on Brad Treliving, here he is now potentially in line for the most sought-after job in the National Hockey League. Like, how does that happen, you know, when that little ding hits your resume, yet I still think his reputation is so sterling around the league that people aren't really worried about that because they understand their circumstances. So, yeah, there's a whole lot of irony at play here, and Tree is right in the middle of all of it. And he can handle it all, man. Like, this guy, any controversy, criticism, it's water off the duck's back for most GMs, but this guy especially just does not care. Mm-hmm. And you have to be that way or else you're paralyzed and you can never make moves for the betterment of your team.
No, that's where I wanted to go next, is that, he's worked in a Canadian market before, and listen, I've been to Alberta, I don't think I've been to Calgary, I need to go, to the Stampede, maybe this is the summer, I would love to go, oh my God, I'd be dying to go.
Oh, you'd love it here, man.
Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't love it there, in the summer? I'll leave the winter to you guys. You guys can have the winter, but I'll come for the Stampede in July. But can you compare the media markets and the fact that he's dealt with a Canadian market, a much smaller Canadian market, but he has dealt with it? Do you think there's a direct translation to the insanity of being the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs?
I don't think there's a job in the NHL that can 100% fully prepare you for the media maelstrom that is Toronto. Like, you know, and And yeah, we're a Canadian market. You know, I guess I'm considered to be pretty critical of the team for the most part, or at times. But you know, we don't have the. It's not as savage as it is in Toronto, for sure. It's not, but it is a Canadian market where you have to speak on regularity. I mean, I marvel at a guy like Tree Living. I used to text Tree Living, you know, I don't know, weekly. You know, this guy's got a million people coming at him at every angle, and Toronto's just going to be that times 10. So, yes, he's prepped for it. I think also the fact that his father is, you know, a very visible, recognizable Canadian. And, you know, Brad is not daunted by, you know, hanging out with the who's who of Canada. I mean, he's been there, done that and all. And so I don't think anything would just kind of overwhelm him. And that's the key. It's a combination of having been in a Canadian market, having also been in the league for a long, long time in very different roles. You know, one of the fascinating parts of his career is him starting that Western Professional League and starting an entire league and building it all over Texas. Like, that's fascinating. And so this guy's really seen every corner of the National Hockey League. And there's actually another great story about Tree Living. Years and years ago, he went to training camp as a player, as a defenseman, but tried out for the Vancouver Canucks. And Brian Burke was there. And Brian Burke was the one who told him, "You're cut." And he said to him, "Your future in hockey is definitely not on the ice. If you want any future in hockey, you better go into management or scouting or something, because you're not good enough to be a player." And lo and behold, here they were working hand in hand to each other in Calgary.
What is the lesson he learned in his time in Calgary, where there was some success there, and even this season again, point better than the Panthers? And I guess, you know, that, like, you look back on the Daryl Sutter of it all, and I think that looms large over what happened, and the goaltending of it all also in Calgary. But, like, what is the overall lesson, if you had to guess, that Brad Tree Living learned from his Calgary Flames tenure?
Well, one of the lessons is you know, if you remember last fall when the season started, everyone anointed Brad Tree Living GM of the year. Mm-hmm. You know, the puck hadn't even dropped, and everybody just thought it was so masterful how he stick-handled through the Tkachuk situation and dealt with the devastation of the Gaudreau situation. And he was the first one to say, like, that doesn't mean squat to me. And he would always say, look, like, we're going to be in tough to make the playoffs. I know everyone thinks we can challenge for the division, but I don't know. I guess the lesson is not to take anything for granted. And you could put all the pieces in place that you think are the proper ones, and yet all you need is one or two things to go sideways, and the whole season can be shot. Or, more specific to the Toronto situation, you could have a phenomenal season in every way, and then everything goes to crap over 10 days in the playoffs, and you're out. Mm-hmm. So he knows that as well as anybody, because there have been some pretty good years in Calgary where they won. One year they won the Western Conference in the regular season. The other year they won their division. And in both cases, you know, they were made short work of in the playoffs. So he knows how tough it is to build a winner. And the one thing Daryl Sutter and him always have said, if you're going to ever win a cup, you've got to be there year after year after year to finally make that breakthrough. And that's where the Leafs are at. Mm-hmm. They're there every year. They just can't make that breakthrough. And, you know, I do think Tree could do a really good job building off of what's in Toronto right now. And, you know, I think the world of the guy. I really do. I as a professional and also as a person.
Well, we'll see. Again, odds on favor to be the next general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Craig Conroy is the next general manager of the Calgary Flames. They stay in-house, but a guy with plenty of experience leading up to this spot. You know, like, he's always, man, always smiling. Always seems like an upbeat dude. And something else stood out for, I mentioned the Daryl Sutter of it all a season ago, and yeah, there were some instances there where wasn't exactly making friends, and certainly some of the exit interviews, I think, for the players. Yeah, not surprising to see him on his merry way. But Craig Conroy talked about the next guy, like, needing to make it a fun place to play, to which I think, oh, yeah, who doesn't want to participate in a fun place? And then I'm like, wait, we are being paid millions of dollars to win hockey games, right? Like, and I'm of two minds here. And one is, like, maybe because it doesn't have the benefit of being sunny Florida, right? Like, it is Calgary, that is a way to lure free agents, although they were able to do so with with Nazem Kadri. What do you make of that kind of stuff that we're talking about? Hey, it needs to be, not only do we need to pay these players millions of dollars and make them wealthy beyond their wildest dreams, but it also needs to be fun for them because they didn't have enough fun under Daryl Sutter.
I get it. And there are a lot of people who say, oh my God, these players, these precious little players couldn't handle a little bit of tough love from their coach, blah, blah, blah. You have to understand the culture that was built over the last couple of years under Daryl Sutter. It was miserable around here. And I'm not talking about that as a media guy who had to deal with his antics in the press room every day. I'm talking about players hating coming to the rink every single day. And that's what Conroy's talking about. Like, there's seven guys who are going to be UFAs after this season, and I can tell you that the bulk of them have all spoken openly with one another, not publicly, but with one another about how they all can't wait to get out. And that's because it was so... I mean, this is the place fun forgot under Daryl Sutter. So they've addressed that, and that's why Craig Conroy is the perfect guy to come in right now and speak in those terms, because this guy, his enthusiasm and personality is absolutely infectious. Literally 1 minute before you called me, I dropped him off. I gave him a ride. We were at a function today with Phil Esposito and him and a charity event. And I dropped him off at the Saddle Dome, and as he got out of the car, there were a group of kids there, and you would have thought that he was Jerome McGinley or I don't know who else, but this guy is so over-the-top popular in this city. This city is so proud of him, and his press conference the other day, I referred to it as a coronation more than a press conference, because people just couldn't – they're so happy that a good guy finally got the job, and that this team, which everyone knows – has had a miserable run over the last year. It's finally going to get some fresh air breathed into it by a guy who everybody loves. So that's what he's talking about. I'm with you, Ben. Like, it is up to my, when you hear, I just want it to be fun. No, this is pro sports, guys. It's not about fun. I don't care if you have a fun day in your life. You have a job to do, but it's hard to do your job, as you know. Well, yeah. I don't know who your boss is these days. Well, I do know who your boss is these days. But
the great people.
But if you're... Yeah, fantastic. Aren't they wonderful?
They're
I love them all.
I love them.
But the very best. But I'm just saying, you know, we all know, every listener knows, if you're not happy at work, you're not going to do your best work. And that was why the Calgary Flames fell short of their expectations last year. Players were miserable, and that's why they failed miserably.
Yeah, and is like, has this sport, and maybe pro sports in general, left like the Daryl Sutters, the Scotty Bowmans, the Mike Keenans in the rearview mirror? Like, can you exist like that anymore in this day and age?
No, I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I just think, I thought what Don Maloney said when they recently at a press conference, he said, 10 years ago, like the players, you know, a bunch of them really spoke up and had their say about how miserable they were this year. He said, oh, that never would have happened. Like, players just didn't do that. And 20 years ago, players, you know, you said jump, they jumped, and maybe they'd say, how high, coach? Now they jump, and they say, or they don't jump, they say, why am I jumping? And then they also ask, what's in it for me if I jump? And so today's athlete has just changed, and the coaching style has to change too. You have to be more about positivity. And because also today's athletes, they're just too honest and open. Their careers are short. They're run like businesses. And if they're not happy, they're going to go to their agent. The agent's going to go to the team, and they're going to demand a trade. And at the end of the day, most of the time, players get exactly what they want. So are the inmates running the asylum? Maybe, but that's just the way it works these days.
Yep. It's true. Why not have it all? If you can have it all, and today's professional athlete can have it all. And hey, if you're Matthew Tkachuk, you can live in Florida, you can win a Stanley Cup, and you can get paid millions of dollars, and nobody gets to yell at you at practice. So yeah,
100%. Like, I tell this story all the time lately. You know, when the Calgary Flames were in Florida this year, we went to we had a couple nights in Florida before the game, and eight of his former teammates, Flames players, all went to Matthew's house. And Tkachuk's got a place on the ocean now with jet skis in the backyard and a pool and a hot tub. And you know, it's fully catered and fresh cold beer, and it's hot outside. Everyone's wearing flip-flops. You telling me that those eight players are not all looking at him going, this could be me. Like, not all of them are going to make the money Matthew Tkachuk made, but even the guys who probably only going to make more like $2 million a year tops, they're still looking at it going, I could live in Dallas. I could live in Florida. I could live in Anaheim. I could live in L.A. Why do I live in Calgary? And so, or Toronto, like, and I love Toronto too, but, you know, the media cesspool that's there,
cesspool. Take it easy, Eric.
That was uncalled for. But you, for lack of a better term, the scrutiny.
Yeah.
The scrutiny you guys put these guys through. And, hey, we put them through it in Calgary, but not to the same degree. But, yeah, it's hard for these athletes because, like I said, their career's short. And you get to free agency a lot sooner than you ever used to. And you have choices. And a lot of these guys are realizing it's worth sacrificing money to be in the right place with the right coach, the right climate, whatever it is that's your jam, mm-hmm. you can get your jam on now. And Tkachuk is the most incredible example of that. He could have signed here for 8 years. They could have made him the captain, and that would have been great for him too. But he saw something else that he wanted, and he went out and got it.
Yeah, and it's turned out roses for him and the Panthers.
Oh, man.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Eric, yeah. This was great, despite the fact that you said I work in a cesspool. How dare you?
Oh, I'm sorry, buddy. You'll get over it. It's Friday.
I'll be fine.
Within an hour, you're going to be on a patio within an hour, and you will not worry about a thing I said.
No, I'll have forgotten entirely about this conversation. It was great, though. But, yeah, I'll have forgotten about it. See you, Eric.
Yeah, man. Cheers, buddy.
All right, cheers. There's Eric Francis, Sportsnet Flames reporter. Man, yeah, I love this country. I love this time of year. Like, now it's a real palatable place to live when you can go outside and it feels nice to do so. And next week it's going to be like upper 20s. That's amazing. But yeah, in February, do I not think about how it would be much better for my mental health, for every part of my life to be in a place that wasn't minus 20? Yeah. And if I was making my millions of dollars either way and I had a choice and I could choose, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's the appeal of, hey, you get all the attention when you're in a Canadian market, and specifically this one, don't get better than being a Toronto Maple Leaf when things are going well. And if you have even a modicum of playoff success, look at how many, you know, 90s Leafs are still making coin off of not all that successful playoff runs. That's an appeal. It's also an appeal to do what Matthew Tkachuk is doing. Like, you just, it's hard to tell myself, I won't speak for you, but it would be hard for me to say all that other stuff that might come from winning in a Canadian market outdoes the, like, just quality of life and still the ability to win a Stanley Cup. Do you think Steven Stamkos at all regrets returning to Tampa? Probably not. All right. Time now for Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. Stanley Cup playoffs with an off day today. Of course, the Panthers just home chilling out. The Western Conference Final resuming tomorrow, and thank goodness we have that, as Dallas wins in overtime. Vegas still favorites to win the series in five games. They are minus 137, the Stars plus 118. Tomorrow, the Eastern Conference Final in the NBA resumes as we get a game five in that series as well. Game six, in fact, as Boston stays alive, looking to become the first NBA team to come back from 3-0. They're three-point favorites in Miami against the Heat, trying to force a game seven. And tonight, right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet, the Blue Jays minus 152 with Kevin Gausman on the hill against the Minnesota Twins and Louis Varland, who are plus 133. That was Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. All right. Last second Blue Jays news for you. Danny Jansen on the IL. Tyler Heineman activated today for the game. Blair and Barker will have you for a couple hours getting you set for first pitch in Minnesota. I'm Ben Ennis. Have a great weekend, everybody. This has been The Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.